Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick O'Shaughnessy at History Chappie on social media. On behalf of the Versus History editorial team, we are absolutely delighted to be joined today by author Eamon Toland, who read Modern History and Economics at St Hugh's College, Oxford, where he received a Lawler Foundation scholarship. We're delighted to be talking to Eamon today about his brand new book, The Pursuit of Kindness, From Collaboration to Cruelty and Back Again, An Evolutionary History of Human Nature. Eamon, welcome to Versus History. We are absolutely delighted to have you with us for this episode today.
Patrick, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Welcome to the show. Would you mind telling us a little bit about you, your brand new book, and how you came to write it and how you became so passionate about the history of kindness in particular? Because that's not a topic I've read about too often, although kindness, as we know, is pivotal and sacrosanct to our very existence. So over to you. Tell us all about it.
Patrick, thank you. Well, I guess I could say I've always been fascinated by human nature and how and why we're kind, and also how we justify cruelty to ourselves. And I guess academically, I got into the subject while I was in Oxford about 30 years ago, and I was studying slavery in America. And I guess it's a little known fact that in parts of the Deep South, slavery was originally illegal. So in the colony of Georgia, which also included Alabama and Mississippi, for the first two decades, there was a total ban on slavery when it was founded in the 1730s. And it was only after there was huge demand for, cotton and other commodities in the Deep South, that people pivoted their whole view on slavery and whether it was a good or a bad thing. So, they went from banning slavery to legalizing it to having slave codes that prevented, Black people from being able to read or write or in any way, show their equality. And I found this fascinating because, America is a country which, is the cradle of the Declaration of Independence, a country that declared all men are created equal. Yes, at the same time, Thomas Jefferson, the man who wrote that declaration, had hundreds of slaves and exploited them in various ways, including sexually. So I found it intriguing that a society that in many ways was very progressive, brought together democracy, at least for white men, far earlier than the UK did, and had a whole series of rights, including a First Amendment right to first speech, could also be so unenlightened, could actually justify slavery to themselves and really, as I said, turn their moral code upside down. But I guess that kind of lingered in the back of my mind. It was intriguing. And I wanted to understand how, if you like, kind people could do such cruel things. But I guess that the second motivation or impulse to write the book was a kind of a very personal one. When I was about 29, I was coming off a long-haul flight from Hong Kong and landing at Heathrow when I had a pulmonary embolism, which I didn't realize. So as I was walking off the plane, a blood clot, went from my legs, through my heart, into my lungs, blocked all the oxygen from going to my brain, and I just collapsed unconscious and was rushed to hospital. And it was an opportunity, not that I sought it, to really see the best and the worst of human nature. So, the NHS absolutely saved my life. I wouldn't be here today if it hadn't been for them. And yet at the same time, I'd collapsed just before Christmas, which in the NHS is known as a time for granny dumping, when families will take perfectly healthy relatives who are often released from care homes and literally just dump them in hospital over the Christmas period rather than look after them at home. So it was an extraordinary experience to be there at the time, hooked up to various machines in a disused operating theater. And I was surrounded by lonely, dying men, essentially. And while they took great care of us, they were overwhelmed by all of these healthy people who'd been dumped in their hospital. So, there was one day where they actually forgot to feed us for 12 hours. Nobody just came into us because they were just so swamped. And obviously it was a disused room most of the time. So that gave me a very personal reason for wanting to write The Pursuit of Kindness. I wanted to really understand how it is that we are kind. And as you say, it's sacrosanct in human nature. And at the same time, how we can be so cruel. So really, I've spent the next 20 years since that collapse at Heathrow, really trying to understand it, and hence the book, which is coming out today.
Fantastic, Eamon. So it's born out of history itself, but also some very, very personal experiences too. Okay, I think you've touched on a little bit of this already, but what's the book all about then? And well, I think you've told us why you chose to write it. So if we pick up a copy, if we go and get a copy from Kindle or Amazon, what are we going to find in there? What's it all about?
Well, I think the first thing is a kind of a reminder of something that we should already know, but I think has been often challenged, which is that we are naturally predisposed to kindness and collaboration. You know, and I know a lot of people have read books like the excellent book by Richard Dawkins, The Selfish Gene. But in reality, you know, our genes are not selfish. And so part of the book is describing the evolutionary history of our species over the last 300,000 years. And why it is that that we have evolutionary reasons to be kind. So the book makes the point that, you know, evolution and natural selection doesn't really care whether we're naughty or nice. And if kindness and collaboration help our genes to make copies of themselves, then kindness and collaboration can flourish. So the first part of the book is really describing the evolutionary history of humanity and why we had huge incentives to be kind. So and part of it is looking at, you know, things like kin altruism. So if you look at humans, we are described by some people as the mama's boys of nature. Our childhoods are the longest on the planet, which requires huge amounts of resources from our parents to look after us. And it requires that care, otherwise we just wouldn't survive as a species. So that's led to some kind of strange things. I mean, it's not unusual to see kin altruism in the animal kingdom, but the level of kin altruism among humans is extraordinary, particularly among men. So men spend more time looking after their children in the human race than pretty much any other animal species, certainly more than any other primate. And that's unusual for mammals. I mean, it's fairly common to see male birds, for instance, being heavily involved, but not so much male mammals. It's maybe 1 in 10 of the mammal population where you get this heavy male involvement in raising children. And it's often associated with monogamy. So, you know, it's not unusual for people to commit, at least while they're raising the children, to each other to make sure that. And obviously, if you're a woman looking for a partner who you know you're going to rely on for a huge amount of care and protection, you're going to look for somebody who is kind and generous and loyal and all the various positive attributes. So from that point of view, you know, there's already an evolutionary impulse towards kindness because you want somebody who's going to be kind for your children. But there's also another way in which humans are very remarkable, which is in our friendships. It's something that evolutionary biologists call reciprocal altruism. So we have more friendships than really any other species on the planet. And we have developed very complex tools for working together and collaborating together. So for instance, we are very, very good at recognizing other faces. You know, we are very good at learning languages to a much greater sophistication than any other animal on the planet. And we use that capability to really, you know, come together in groups and collaborate. And there's an awful lot of evidence, overwhelming evidence really, for how our friendships really set us apart from pretty much any other group in the animal kingdom. And we now have evidence that that has helped us to actually have a rudimentary moral sense, which is actually built into our DNA. So there's a book by a guy called Paul Bloom called Just Babies, where he describes experiments on 3-month-olds and 6-month-olds and 12-month-olds, where really they just have puppet shows and they have a good guy, a bad guy, and a neutral guy. And they were able to track the eye movements of 3-month-olds, and they always look at the good guy when they're watching the puppet shows. You know, by the time the kids are 6 months, they ask them if they want to reach for a puppet after the show. And bear in mind, they still can't really speak. They're still not using language. But the 6-month-olds overwhelmingly will reach for the good guy. If they can't reach for the good guy, they'll reach for the neutral guy. And only if there's really no choice will they actually want to pick up the bad guy. And by the time they get to 12-month-olds, you know, when they get the kids to reach, at least one of the kids in the study grabbed the good guy and started hitting the bad puppet over the head. So there is this sense of, you know, we have this innate sense of wanting to kind of cheer on the good guy, this innate moral code, which seems to be linked into our need for collaboration. And that's not something that I think people always were aware of. I mean, there was an assumption that warfare has always been around, that we have always been violent, that we've always been, in some ways, we've always had a dark side. But actually, again, if you look at the archaeological record, the oldest war graves we know of are about 14,000 years old. They're in a place called Jebel Sahaba, which is now underwater on the Egyptian-Sudanese border. But it was the first time in our 300,000 year history where you actually got a large number of people with healed wounds buried in a mass grave. So before 14,000 years, at least up until now, we haven't found any earlier evidence of mass scale warfare. You know, we were probably always, would have had a kind of some level of aggression towards each other, particularly somebody who annoyed us or offended us. But that tends to be quite a personal thing where you're righting a wrong, or at least in your own head, you're righting a wrong, as opposed to something more, you know, wide scale like warfare. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, what were we doing for that previous, 300,000 years? And the answer seems to be that we were coming together in small groups, in very small population densities. I mean, as late as about 20,000 years ago, there were probably only about 500,000 of us on the planet, you know, compared to over 7 billion today. And, you know, rather than competing with each other over resources, we had a huge incentive to work together to ward off predators or to find food, particularly for hunting. You know, a lot of hunting is kind of dumb luck. So if you work together at hunting, you can share resources and share food. And if you're lucky one day, you share, but then you benefit from other people sharing with you when they strike lucky. But also in protecting each other against predators or attacks by predators, and also matchmaking across bands. So there tends to be a lot of evidence that, you know, we would come together for large scale hunts. We might fragment a little bit into smaller groups at other times of the year, but we were always collaborating. We were always trying to make sure that we worked together. So there was an evolutionary reason for us being kind and collaborative. So the book goes into that in a bit of detail. But I didn't want to kind of leave it there, that there have been some books out there that have talked about, you know, why we're kind. I also wanted to explore the dark side. And part of that obviously is, you know, if you look back at the history of the last 100 years with the Holocaust, with the mass graves in communist Russia, you can't really say that human beings have always been kind and collaborative. And there have been lots of, you know, scientific research into why we might be cruel. And we know, for instance, that when we're fearful, we can generate oxytocin. Oxytocin helps us to dehumanize other people. So it's called the hug hormone, but it's also something where if you feel under threat, you can rapidly pivot and actually be dehumanized. We also know that people have been very keen to conform. So maybe one part of the problem of collaboration is that we're willing to obey orders. So, you know, there's been a famous series of experiments called the Milgram experiments, where, you know, psychologists got people to give electric shocks in a memory trial. The people didn't realize that they were the subjects. They thought they were testing someone else's memory. But the whole trial was about how far up the dial they would crank the electric shocks. And the person in another room who they were electrocuting was actually an actor. And as they turned up the dial, the actor would bang on the wall and scream and beg for them to stop. And they were interested to see how far people would go. And they got to the depressing conclusion that 60% of people would give somebody, I think, a 450-volt shock, which is way more than would be needed to kill them. You know, and for the last series of shocks, the actor on the other side would be silent. So people wanted to know, you know, why are we so conformist? Is this, you know, the kind of fundamental problem with our dark side? But actually, one thing that they discovered was that, you know, the Milgram experiments were quite stressful. People don't want to, even if they are obeying orders, that they found it very traumatic. So a lot of the subjects who even cranked up the dial, you know, were rocking backwards and forwards. They were weeping. They were biting their nails. They were hugging themselves. It's not something that's natural to human beings. It's not the natural environment that people would do something like this. So it's unlikely that, you know, that instinct to be conformist in itself would explain why we have such a dark side. But one thing I found when I was looking at the history of this in the research was that we are natural born narrators. You know, we're not psychopaths. Maybe 1 in 100 women, maybe no more than 2 or 3 out of 100 men are psychopaths or sociopaths. And for those people, you could say, well, look, the emotional brakes on bad behavior are faulty, if not missing completely. But the vast majority of us will feel bad. We have an inner moral voice if we do something wrong. And the only way we could get past this when we want to behave ruthlessly is by essentially convincing ourselves we were doing the right thing. So we would tell ourselves stories to say why it's the right thing to do whatever we want to do. And particularly as populations expanded in the last 10, 15,000 years and warfare really does start to kick in and you see a great deal more violence. What seems to have happened is we've come up with very convincing lies and excuses to persuade ourselves that we were righting or wrong when in fact we were acting ruthlessly in our own interests. So the book spends a bit of time explaining, you know, how it is that Christians could love their enemies by killing them. And it talks a lot about the Crusades and how the Crusades, you know, pivoted a lot of people's narratives, you know, from one of kind of kindness and compassion to holy war. But it also talks about, you know, something I mentioned earlier about how Enlightenment slaveholders can declare all men are created equal. So it goes into, you know, American slavery pre and post the Declaration of Independence and how people justify to themselves, you know, a very, very ruthless economic system and how that varied across the United States. Obviously, in the North, slavery was eventually illegal. And the further south you got, the more entrenched slavery became. You know, so parts of the Upper South, you know, had freed almost all of their slaves because they weren't growing lucrative crops. But the more lucrative slavery was, you know, the more people were able to justify to themselves. And then it also goes into, you know, why nice people voted Nazis. So again, going into the whole era of the 1930s, the austerity, the fears that people had and the motivations. Because, you know, 17 million people actually voted for the Nazi Party before they you know, declared a state of emergency and took over Germany. So I wanted to kind of go into some of the reasons why somebody might have voted for them. What was their motivation and how they persuaded themselves that that was the right thing? So obviously, you know, it goes to the light and the dark, but I wanted to then take it back to, you know, today. I mean, we've gone through a huge amount of polarization in the last 5 or 10 years, you know, between the election of Donald Trump, the Brexit referendum, you know, and there's an awful lot of, if like, demonizing of people that we disagree with, you know. But the reality is that, you know, 70 or 75 million people voting for Donald Trump are not all white supremacists. They're not all a basket of deplorables. And we can't simply use negative language for people we disagree with without trying to understand their perspective. And of course, we can call them out for things that we disagree with. But we do need to recognize that social media in particular is leading to kind of scapegoating and a vendetta. So in the last section of the book, it kind of talks about how we apply kindness and cruelty today in an era of polarization. And it emphasizes the importance of making space for dissenting voices, for people we disagree with. You know, again, throughout history, it's been minorities often who've been in the vanguard of social change who have actually made a difference. So if you look at the anti-slavery society that was founded in Britain in the 1780s, 9 out of the 12 founders were Quakers, you know, who were a very small minority in the time, but really could see past the bias of the herd and could see why, you know, change had to happen. And even if you go back to the Milgram experiments I mentioned earlier, you know, where 60% of people would crank a button up to obey orders from a psychologist, they found if just one person in the room disagreed with what the psychologist was saying, that conformity collapsed. You know, a dissenting voice, just one, was enough to completely change people's behavior. And actually the number of people who were willing to put on electric shocks kind of dropped by more than 80%. It was no more than 1 in 10 people who actually would apply the electric shocks. So I wanted to, in this book, to show why the polarization has come about currently, but also to remind people that it is possible to reach beyond our biases. And again, as I said, to remind them that we are naturally predisposed to kindness and collaboration. So that's what the book's about.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much, Eamon, for that very, very detailed answer. Okay, one of my favourite questions to put to historians. How did you go about researching this book, Eamon? What were the biggest challenges and difficulties you faced? And I'm going to add to the question, if I may, to triple load it. I'm sure it won't have escaped our listeners' notice. You have an Irish name and a slight Irish accent there. How was your own Irish background? Where you could say kindness hasn't been at the forefront of Irish history, the famine, emigration, etc. The list could go on. How has that played into your perceptions and writing of the book? Over to you.
Sure. I might just start with the last piece first. I mean, obviously, everybody comes at these kinds of subjects with their own background and their own examples of how things have happened in history. As you say, Ireland hasn't always had the happiest of histories. But even then, I found it interesting to dig into the people who were involved in various conflicts and try to turn them into three-dimensional people rather than just two-dimensional villains. So, you know, there are examples, for instance, in Ireland, which actually are relevant for Brexit, I guess. I mean, if you look at the 16th century and the Elizabethan era, you know, there was a large rebellion in Ulster, which was called the 9 Years' War. And, you know, England at the time was losing it. And so a fairly tough commander was appointed, Mountjoy, to try and end the war in terms that would be favorable to Queen Elizabeth. You know, and Queen Elizabeth is somebody I admire. She's somebody who has tremendous bravery. She showed tremendous strength, you know, in front of the Spanish Armada. But, you know, in the 9 Years' War, you know, they didn't have many options in terms of how they would win this. So, you know, according to the kind of conventions of the time, if you can maintain your supply lines while disrupting the supply lines of your enemy, you know, that's what you would do. But, you know, disrupting supply lines in that example meant, you know, destroying food supplies. And it's a fascinating thing that one of the ways that we can be very cruel is if we're not immediately and personally being violent towards somebody else. But, you know, taking away somebody's food can be just as effective in killing them as physically, you know, applying violence. You know, Mountjoy was completely traumatized by this impact. I mean, possibly 100,000 people died in the famine that occurred after this conflict. He talked about how grieved he was. You know, he said, you know, we are killing so many of their churls, we are spoiling so much of their corn that it grieveth me to think it is necessary to do this. So he didn't see it as being something he could avoid. He felt he had to destroy the food supplies, but he could see the consequences, you know, and senior English officers saw children eating the corpse of their mother. Another English officer, Captain Trevor, tried to, you know, impose order and chaos. You know, he tried to maintain law and order. So, you know, when he caught a group of older women who had been killing and eating children, he had them executed. But at the same time, you got this disassociation from the terrible consequences of what they were doing. And the aftermath of the 9 Years' War was that you had a very depopulated Ulster. And actually that then prompted Elizabeth's successor, James I, to say, this would be a marvelous place for a colony. And if we can only bring in some loyal English and Scottish Anglicans into Northern Ireland and create them as a colony and make sure they can't have any native tenants in their land, you know, his courtiers said this will extirp the very root of rebellion. And so that plantation of Ulster occurred around the same time that the plantation in Jamestown in Virginia was happening, around 1609, 1610, that it really got underway. And obviously the tragedy of Northern Ireland has been a series of vendettas and counter vendettas since, in which a lot of people with a lot of, you know, good cause for grievance, but also, you know, have pivoted towards violence. And obviously in Brexit, you know, it has been the problem of maintaining peace in Northern Ireland has just been one of the biggest challenges in, you know, avoiding a hard border on the land side, but also trying to avoid any disruption between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So I guess that obviously emerges in the book. And it emerges in the book also because I think traditional history tends to remember the fights and the wars, but not the kind of scorched earth policies. So if you look at Oliver Cromwell, who's also a fascinating character, you know, he's remembered in Ireland for, you know, massacring 3,000 soldiers in Drogheda when he took the town during the English Civil War, and also massacring people in Wexford. In reality, Cromwell seems to have been very disciplined as a soldier, and he took another town, Clonmel, where his troops had suffered horrendous losses. But when they discovered that the garrison had left, they didn't actually kill any civilians. They were very disciplined. It was actually his son-in-law, Henry Ireton, who again then brought in these scorched earth policies, which probably killed 200,000 people after Cromwell had left. So I don't want to demonize or lionize people, but it was interesting that, you know, we remember the stuff which is in battles, but we don't remember often the suffering which just happens from, from famines and from ways in which we distance ourselves, but actually wind up being far more cruel. And that certainly wound up being a passion in wars of religion and a whole series of other wars further on. So sorry for answering in kind of reverse order, but I think that I drew some examples from Irish history, but also other history to show how that emerged. Researching the book, obviously, over the last 20 years has been a challenge for a number of reasons. I mean, obviously, one of the challenges was that a lot of the research didn't exist when I started, you know, reading into the subject. Back in around 2000, which is when I really became interested, and again, I think the conventional wisdom was still, you know, the kind of selfish gene that we had been born selfish. And I knew that was flawed. One of the reasons you can tell that's flawed is because Dawkins and evolutionary biologists were relying on a definition of kindness called altruism that required kindness to come at a personal cost. So if you had kindness that was collaborative, that really related to, you know, win-win outcomes, then that really wasn't part of their technical definition of altruism. So it's probably not surprising that they just decided that if you are selfless in a way that reduces your biological fitness, then you're putting yourself in a path to extinction. Well, of course you are. But the reality is that the vast majority of kindness that we show to each other tends to have its own reward. You know, if we're kind to others, people are kind back to us. And that behavior has been able to flourish. But it took a while to kind of get some of the research material together to actually understand that. In the meantime, obviously, I've got a day job and became father to a son who's now 15. And while that was a huge motivation to continue researching kindness, I think anyone who's had a child will know parenthood can be pretty exhausting and pretty all-consuming. So I was trying to snatch hours of research in between, you know, being a dad and doing my job. And then actually also, I had a second embolism a few years ago, which was followed by a heart attack because I had a blood clot that jumped through a hole in my heart. So all of that kind of took time away from trying to research a book while I had a metal device put in my heart to close up a hole. So my son now calls me Tony Stark or Iron Man just because of where I am.
Yeah.
But you know, what was helped me was a number of books got published over the last 10 years. So Paul Bloom published his book, Just Babies, in 2013, which is where a lot of the research I mentioned on how we have a rudimentary and innate moral sense came out. A guy called Joshua Green published a book called Moral Tribes, which showed how various parts of our brain light up when we're violent. And he considers something called the trolley problem, which is very famous in psychology. And he basically put people through brain scans as they were working out various dilemmas. You know, when is it right to kill one person to save five? And what he discovered was if we have to do anything which feels like violence, you push somebody over a bridge or do anything to touch them to actually kill them in order to save other people, you know, we instinctively will be revulsed. So a part of the brain called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex lights up. If we are distanced from the action, if we're pressing a button, if there's some way that we're not physically in contact with people, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex lights up, which is, you know, where we do our sums, and it says, well, saving five is better than killing one. And so we tend not then to have the kind of emotional reaction if we have to do something. So that came out in the last few years. And then also a really important piece by two anthropologists, a guy called Jonathan Haas and Matthew Piscitelli of the Field Museum, who showed how, they were looking for evidence of warfare and conflict before, you know, the ruins of Jebel Sahaba, which I mentioned, which are 14,000 years old. So they took a look through all the skeletons that have been found from 50,000 years ago to about 15,000 years ago. And there's been about 3,000 skeletons found in about 400 different locations. And fewer than five of them have any signs of violence. So that to me was one of the clinchers, because again, a lot of archaeologists have assumed that we have always been fighting, we've always had conflict, which made little sense to me, given that, you know, there were so few of us on the planet. But actually the piece by Hassan Piscitelli really helped me to kind of seal it, the point that says, no, actually, you know, warfare has not always been in human history. Certainly, you know, we are capable of being aggressive. We probably always had high homicide rates. But actually, for the vast majority of human history, most of our incentives have been towards kindness and collaboration. So that that was the piece of the jigsaw that unlocked the book for me. And then it's been a feverish case of trying to write it up and get it published.
Thanks, Eamon. I think that segues really nicely into the following question. A leitmotif of the book is that collaboration is more deeply ingrained in humanity than competition, and that it's only by working together that human beings can actually prosper. So what historical individuals, events, themes, and or processes could you highlight for us, Eamon, to demonstrate and showcase this?
So, I think the problem we have actually is that we don't see what's in front of our face every day. There have been a whole series of ethnographies of modern hunter-gatherer tribes, which have shown that actually they are very good at sharing. Again, it's the whole logic and structure of being in a hunter-gatherer group, where, as I said, if you can actually find food one day and somebody else finds food another day, you actually wind up being much better off by sharing. So there's been research into modern hunter-gatherer groups that says that bands of about 100 people need about 40% less foraging area to get their food than bands of 10 or less. So there's been a bit of science, if you like, and if you like, the anthropology of those groups, which have shown that they have really been benefited from kindness and collaboration. And actually, if you look at the anthropology of it, while we probably always had high homicide rates, and there's certainly a lot of evidence for people fighting each other, even in those hunter-gatherer groups, it tends to be over moral issues. It tends to be over a slight or an insult, some impact, something where they feel that people have been morally wronged, or if they feel that somebody's cursed them, and that kind of history has been there. But they tended most of the time actually not to be violent, so that they use an awful lot of tools, including shaming, if people cheat, to avoid conflict, to avoid violence. And where there is conflicts, 98% of them are resolved without violence. Then if you go into the archaeological record, I think, while those hunter-gatherer bands were great when there were very few of us around, the problem that we have is that once populations start to explode, then they're not ideal in terms of resolving conflicts. So that's where we get into the history. About 12,000 years ago, we start seeing populations go from around 2 million. By 2,000 years ago, the population is between 150 and 300 million. And in that time frame, two things have happened. One is that the climate has stabilized. So we've gone to the Holocene, which is where we've been for the last 12,000 years, which is a much more stable climate in terms of growing times, in terms of storms, in terms of disruptions. And the second thing, obviously, is we invented agriculture. And that really, really helped people to massively boost populations and massively boost yields. The problem at that point then is if you're knocking around in bands of 30 or 40, if you get into a conflict, you can't just move to the neighboring valley or the neighboring area. I mean, one of the challenges that you have then is spaces are filling up, particularly areas which are very fertile. You're getting an awful lot of more people bouncing against each other. And being in a band of 30 or 40 people can be challenging because at that point, if you're growing food and somebody else is growing food, but something goes wrong with your crops, you absolutely have a motivation to take somebody else's crops. If you like, private property probably really kicked off about 10,000 years ago. They've done some digs in the Fertile Crescent that show that what they call pre-pottery Neolithic farmers started organizing, rather than organizing villages or in bands, start organizing in family groups from about 10,000 years ago. And it seems that we started using families as an area for us to kind of like rely on each other. So we weren't relying on other people for hunts and sharing anymore. We were relying on our own work to raise our own crops. But that meant we had something worth stealing. It meant that if something went wrong with our crops, we had incentive to steal from other people. And you can imagine in that situation, those idyllic hunter-gatherer bands, when there's too many of them, what you've got are a lot of scattered warlords and a lot of raiding. So, it does look like warfare did kick in and societies became much more violent at that point because there was an awful lot worth stealing. And frankly, there was an awful lot of high risk of if you didn't do it, somebody else would do it to you. So then what happens, and this is where the historical themes kick in, is we start developing cultural solutions to those conflicts. I mean, one of the solutions was to scale up in society. If you have larger societies, more complex societies, with a ruler or a king, then the benefit of the king is not just in their own, you know, in unique qualities. It's the fact that you get fewer individual warlords fighting against each other. So there is evidence in Mesoamerica that people who have, or the areas that became kingdoms, the death rate from warfare possibly dropped by about a third just from scaling up. So you go from scattered bands of warlords to larger, more complex societies. So one of the things we did was to create kingdoms. Kingdoms themselves helped to reinforce the rule of law, and so that helped with peace, but it also, and collaboration, but it also meant that we had increasing hierarchies. So you had richer, you had poorer. You know, if your parents died young or you fell sick, you might wind up in debt to somebody else who might then prosper. So you could see social stratifications kicking in. Another thing which you can see in the historical record, which we then did to try and encourage collaboration culturally, was we invented patriarchy, which is an odd one to mention in this context for collaboration. But we know that, as I said before, one of the strongest drivers of altruism is kin altruism. You know, when you share genes with fellow kin, you are kinder to them, you look after them. And one way to avoid conflict among more complex societies was to actually enforce patriarchy. You would basically turn women into assets, which would allow you then to do deals between tribes. And again, there's a huge amount of evidence that says groups that actually share marriage partners between them are much less likely to go to war. And it's kind of a self-reinforcing circle. You know, you create alliances by having people marry and raise children, and that actually in itself helps to reduce the risk of future conflict. But obviously, you know, there's no guarantee that people are going to like each other or even want to be with each other. So essentially, they create a culture of patriarchy, which enforces these strict codes about who you're going to sleep with, who you're going to be told you have to sleep with, in order to encourage collaboration. And part of the book traces through the Hebrew Bible, you know, the story of Deborah, and then later, if you like, Jewish heroines. You know, if you look at Deborah, you know, 3,500 years ago, she is a female judge. She is successful in her own right. She happens to be married, but she is the person who rallies Israel to defeat their enemies. And she's a leader. You then get to somewhere like Ruth, who was the great grandmother of King David. And it's only a few hundred years later. But by that point, Ruth is defined by her husband. When her husband dies, she becomes a widow. She has to find another man to marry, otherwise she's in trouble. And she eventually finds a kinsman of her husband to marry. But before he can marry her, he has to go to an even closer relative and agree with him that he doesn't want the dead husband's property, which includes the wife. So he hands over a sandal to the closer relative so he can marry Ruth. And then, a few hundred years after that, you get to somebody like Esther, who is, in Persia. And she's essentially a concubine of the king. The king has booted out his previous queen because she refused to parade wearing only a crown in front of his court. And Esther essentially wins a beauty contest, which saves the Jewish people in Persia from genocide, and she becomes the queen. So it sounds like a happy ever after story, but within the course of 700 years, you've gone from this very powerful figure like Deborah, who is autonomous and has her own agency, to a figure like Esther, who's famous essentially for staving off a genocide by being the sex slave of a king, and where she could very easily have been killed, as she negotiated her way through through society. So it's interesting because the historical trend, if you look, we think of it as negative, which it is. Obviously, patriarchy is negative, hierarchy is negative, slavery is negative. But some of these, if you like, institutions are cultural workarounds, because it's not as easy to be kind and collaborative when we're no longer hunter-gatherers. So we used these historical devices and cultures to actually help to maintain kindness and collaboration. Then obviously what you find, post-Enlightenment is you then find us swinging back towards, if you like, a more natural way of living in terms of how we think about each other and how we think about fellow human beings. And so, we then see patriarchy being reversed back. We invent contract law. We invent a much more involved state, which actually helps us to do, to have those common rules, which are incredibly collaborative and incredibly sophisticated, and which actually have allowed us to minimize conflict. So even in the last 30, 40 years, the level of warfare has collapsed since the end of the Cold War, we're probably living, even though it doesn't seem like it, in one of the most peaceful times there has been really since the dawn of agriculture.
Again, that segues nicely into the next question, which is one of my favorites, I think, because it's about the present and the potential for history shaping the future. So it won't have escaped many people's notice that the news, whichever outlets or platforms we select, from CNN to Fox to RTE to Al Jazeera, you could name any of them there, they can appear to be somewhat negative. Is this notion actually grounded in reality, or is it just perception? Is there cause for hope? Are we actually misreading the news? Is the news misreading events, or is there cause actually for hope?
I mean, no, there's absolutely cause for hope. I mean, part of the problem, and you know, it's the joke, but they say if it bleeds, it leads. You know, as I said, we're natural born narrators. We look for a story, and the exciting story is that, you know, whatever is happening that we want to hear about, and that could be a tragedy of some sort. It's a little bit more mundane and boring when you hear that people have been lifted out of poverty, that we are, you know, vaccinating more people than we ever have, that we have eliminated so many diseases in the last 30 or 40 years. And if you look back to where we were at the fall of the Iron Curtain and today, I mean, over 1 billion people have been lifted out of poverty. So somebody said, you could write a headline, you know, over 100,000 lifted out of poverty today, every day for the last 20 years. You know, so we've become more prosperous. We have, as I think we've seen during the pandemic, shown a great deal of resilience and togetherness while there's been tensions. You know, it hasn't been the kind of zombie apocalypse that people might have thought of. People have clapped for frontline workers. They have cheered them on. You know, we've shown a level of solidarity that frankly, the news doesn't always portray. I mean, it's something that actually a guy called Rutger Bregman says in a book of his called Humankind, that, you know, we're used to placebos, but the news is what he calls a nocebo. Essentially, it's one of those things which presents the negative all the time in a way that actually, it doesn't actually correspond to reality, because it's more newsworthy. You know, we go for the scandal, we go for the gossip, we go for the bad news stories. But the reality has been that we're more prosperous than ever before, more peaceful than ever before. Yeah, the challenge is we're more polarized than we have been for 20 or 30 years, even though our attitudes are, if anything, more enlightened and more tolerant than they have ever been. So if you look to the US, you know, Democrats and Republicans tend not to be close friends. They've done surveys where, you know, 55% of Democrats say they have no or few close friends who are Republicans. Actually, so 65% of Democrats say that. Republicans, it'll be about 55% who have no or few close friends who are Democrats. And that's way up from where it was in the Clinton era, for instance. Over the last 30 years, it's probably trebled in terms of the level of polarization. The reality is, for all of the kind of negative aspersions people throw across each other, they do tend to agree a lot more. So Republicans, for instance, have more tolerant views or more progressive views on things like immigration, gay rights, and affirmative action than Democrats used to have during the Clinton era. You know, people have moved on. And sometimes I think the polarization of the news cycle gives air cover to very obnoxious policies, which actually aren't supported by the vast majority of people. So one of the things I encourage people in the book is to kind of look beyond the news, look beyond their social media echo chamber, and actually go out and listen to dissenting voices, listen to those you disagree with. Because actually the reality is you do have a lot in common. You know, the world is in a much better place than we think. And it's important that we tell a different story. So we don't just tell a story of polarization, where we try to show how much we have in common and come together again to realize our potential.
Okay, a couple of questions left from me. This one's pivoted on a quote, and you state in the book, maintaining the pursuit of kindness in civil society takes substantial cognitive effort in order to check our own biases. We may not be as morally retarded as our forebears, to quote Steven Pinker, but our passion for our values, whether liberal or conservative, still leads us to dismiss opponents or policies because of the labels that we attach to them, making it harder to consider dissenting voices in an era of polarization. What do you mean by that, Eamon? And what can actually be done about it, in your view?
So, I mean, this is one of those points where I think I mentioned to you that, you know, we are natural born narrators and we are passionate. And again, there's a lot of evidence that says that my side or confirmation bias is a real thing. You know, that they've taken people and just given them evidence from a traffic accident and asked them to guess the fair amount of damages that should be paid. And we found that the guesses people make are vastly different if they don't know who they are acting on behalf of before they make the guess. So if they are just asked to neutrally, you know, make a guess, they will come up with a very accurate answer. If they're told you're acting on behalf of the defendant or the plaintiff, they come up with a very different answer. And it's because we do subconsciously, skew evidence in our favor. And actually, one of the challenges of that my side bias, it's obviously a strength when you're trying to argue for yourself and your own beliefs. But when we're passionate in our beliefs and we're passionate in our values, we may be right, but it won't be because we're listening to other people. And that's obviously a dangerous blind spot to have. And again, if you go through the history of the Christians who killed their enemies to show their love for them, or the Enlightenment slaveholders who thought all men are created equal, or even the nice people who voted Nazi, these are three-dimensional human beings with real agency. And I describe why and how they, if you like, fall into the trap of the dark side, how their fears or their passions lead them to discount the kind of evidence that they should. But actually, we're also self-aware creatures. We're rational creatures. So even though we're passionate, we're also able to learn and understand and go beyond our passions. And so part of the book is trying to describe how we do that. And part of that is simply by recognizing we're passionate in the first place, recognizing that we are all biased. And when we use language like basket of deplorables, or we simply demonize, or we pile on somebody on Twitter, all we're doing is giving ourselves a moral high. We're giving ourselves a moral catharsis, but we're not really thinking through what we believe. And the mistake there is, if you do that, you wind up getting outcomes which you certainly don't want. If you're, for instance, when Hillary Clinton described Trump's supporters as a basket of deplorables, the negative vote for Trump was about three times higher than previous Republican got. In other words, three times as many people voted for Trump because they didn't like Hillary than because they liked Donald. You create these reactions when you have a polarization. So we have a real incentive not to not to let our passion completely sway us, acknowledge it, understand it, but then also try to listen to other people, which we are capable of doing. And we have certainly a template. We have shown solidarity through COVID. We have shown solidarity, the West showed extraordinary solidarity through the Cold War. There are times when people will come together, they recognize a common interest, and that instinct for collaboration really comes to the fore. And that's what I'm encouraging people to do now. We have the ability to do it. It's whether we want prefer to sit back in our, stew in our passions, or whether we'd rather see a better world where, our own, ability to be kind and collaborative comes back to the fore. And that's something I'm encouraging people to use. Use their brains, listen to others, and therefore, they will have that ability to, particularly if they recognize where they're most passionate. If you're really passionate about something, don't assume that you're going to be the most objective. And check that bias to the point where at least you make a point and make an effort of listening fairly to other people who disagree with you.
Thank you so much, Eamon. The final question then, what are the 2 to 3 takeaway points that you would like readers to know or remember about your book?
I think the first one is that we are naturally predisposed to kindness and collaboration. We have evolutionary reasons for it. We have social reasons for why we couldn't have survived as a species without doing that. And that includes natural sense and expectation that we have rights and other people have rights. We expect other people to show kindness, and we will show kindness in return. So I'd like people to get that, take that away. I'd like, to your previous question, for people to take away the point that despite that kindness, we can be tremendously passionate. We don't reason dispassionately. And if you like, smarter people tend to come up with smarter excuses for their behavior. And all too often we can convince ourselves we are good, and that makes it easier for us to do bad. So I'd like people to take away the idea that yes, we are passionate, and that's not a bad thing, but we don't necessarily then weigh things up objectively. And then the third thing I think is that we should reach beyond our biases. Again, we have the capability to do this and the self-awareness to do this, and say we may be passionate and that's okay, but we need to actively listen to those who disagree with us and cherish dissenting voices, because those minorities are the people who lead us towards greater progress and greater kindness.
Thank you so much, Eamon. A tour de force of an interview. if anyone needed a pick-me-up and something to cling on to in these potentially dark days about kindness, well, you have given them reason to hope and a tour de force of history along the way as well. Thank you so much for your time, Eamon, for coming on Versus History. We are so, so grateful.
Patrick, it was an absolute pleasure, and thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I wish you all the luck and success in the future with the podcast.
It's thank wonderful. You. You are welcome back anytime, Eamon. Speak soon.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. All the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.